Matter of State versus Laquan Harris. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. John Albright on behalf of Laquan Harris, Office of the Public Defender.
Good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Prosecutor Michelle Buckley for the State.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Daniel A. Finkelstein, appearing as a friend of the court on behalf of the Attorney General of New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Albright, please go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Distilled to its essence, this petition on behalf of my client, Laquan Harris, presents the court with the basic question of whether the familiar function of weighing the evidence, which our law is assigned to juries and judges performing their duties as finders of fact, may properly be performed anew by appellate courts reviewing judgments and PCR appeals. In this case, after an evidentiary hearing, the PCR court granted a new trial based upon ineffective assistance of counsel. And the appellate division reversed and reinstated the conviction, emphasizing its disagreement with the PCR judge's weighing of the evidence. There's no more obvious example of this disagreement than the panel's rejection of the PCR judge's finding that the state's witness, India Bowers, was, quote, one of the state's most important witnesses at defendant's trial, while the appellate division wrote in its opinion that, in its view, quote, Bowers was not one of the most important witnesses at trial. At trial, the state called Bowers to establish that my client had argued with the victim of the shooting, in this case, Antonio Davis, shortly before it occurred. Bowers also testified that Mr. Harris had threatened the victim. When the appellate division decided that Bowers was not one of the most important witnesses at trial, it essentially decided that the testimony of the other witnesses was sufficient to establish defendant's motive, and that therefore the defendant would have been convicted even without Bowers' testimony. This betrayed the deference required to fact-finding by the applicable standard of review, by failing to recognize that this finding was based upon the lower court's feel of the case. In criminal cases, juries use the same feel of the case to pronounce guilt or innocence after weighing the evidence. In short, weighing the evidence based on the feel of the case is the bridge between pure facts and legal application. Put another way, finding that Strickland's prejudice prong is met is not a pure legal question. It is a mixed question that involves factual finding and application of law to facts in the same way a jury reaches a verdict in a criminal trial. Here, the appellate division failed to recognize that Bowers' most important testimony was not about motive or hostility, but about an actual alleged recent threat by Mr. Harris to shoot the victim in a case where the victim was shot just a few hours later. Nothing is more ingrained in the law of criminal evidence than a threat to commit an act consistent with an act occurring soon thereafter is powerful evidence of the guilt of the person who allegedly made the threat. And so the appellate division could only reach a determination as to the relative importance of various witnesses by weighing the evidence. In doing so, the appellate division acted as if it were in a position that it actually was not, to hear the testimony of witnesses at trial and at the PCR evidentiary hearing. There, the PCR judge heard from petitioner's trial counsel who, one, failed to impeach Bowers with her prior criminal convictions, two, failed to do any investigation into other potential witnesses, including Alicia McCrary, when the PCR hearing established that she would have testified that she had no recollection of an argument between petitioner and the victim before the shooting, even though she was allegedly with Bowers at the time, and three, failed to impeach Bowers with her inconsistent statements concerning her supposed other sighting of the defendant running near the crime scene. This was all substantial, credible evidence that necessitated deference at the appellate level. Instead, the panel disregarded in favor of weighing the evidence anew. Petitioner submits that the court's jurisprudence in the area of original jurisdiction should guide the answer to the question of whether PCR judges or appellate panels are properly empowered to weigh all the evidence and testimony following an evidentiary hearing. In State versus Maselli, the court was presented with a dissent from the appellate division in which Judge Fisher aptly wrote, "Unlike my colleagues who appear to have exercised original jurisdiction on the weight issues, I am willing to express a view of the weight of the evidence since I was not present when the witnesses testified. Rather than hazard a view of the evidence from a cold record, I would remand for reexamination of the second prong, including for the first time the trial court's weighing of the corrupting effect of the police procedure in light of our unanimous conclusion that the procedure was impermissibly suggestive." Ultimately, the court agreed with Judge Fisher's view, holding that the core issue before it was the panel's exercise of original jurisdiction. and that it was improper for the majority of the panel to make factual findings and weigh the evidence based only upon a hearing transcript. Like in Maselli, the core issue in this case is the panel's unwarranted exercise of original jurisdiction, marked by its disregard of the PCR judge's weighing of the evidence based on her feel of the case. Here, the appellate panel usurped the basic fact-finding function of the PCR court, and the court is respectfully urged to restore the judgment granting PCR to petitioner.
Mr. Albright, can you please identify for us the particular errors that defense counsel made that establish ineffective assistance of counsel? You sure. Ticked off three as I counted during your opening. Just tell us, listing them, you can get into more detail later, what are the errors that you rely upon?
That was actually, Your Honor, what I was going to begin with, and that I mentioned three, and those are the ones that I really wanted to focus on because...
I'm not asking what you're focusing on with us. Sure. What are the errors that you rely on in order to lead us to conclude that there was ineffective assistance of counsel? Just sure. Tick them off, please.
Trial counsel's admission at the PCR hearing that he failed to impeach Bowers with her criminal convictions for theft by deception and bad checks.
That's one. Tick off however many there are that you're relying on. I just want to cover that first at the outset of the argument.
Sure. Well, again, I have three that I'll list for the court again. The trial counsel's admitted failure to investigate Alicia McCrary as a potential witness who would call Bowers' testimony into question. And the third one that I already mentioned was trial counsel's admitted failure to investigate the dying declaration of the victim, Mr. Davis. There are others that the court didn't explicitly rely on, such as trial counsel's failure to impeach Bowers with respect to her various inconsistent statements, both before and after and during trial, but that wasn't specifically relied on by the PCR judge to. But I would say.
This isn't a trick question.
No.
I'd like you to tell us what it is that you are relying on. What are the issues themselves? And now I count perhaps four?
Perhaps four.
Is that,
I'll leave it
is
at
that
four.
The universe?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is my question to you. I'm concerned about the record. So you raise the issue of the failure to investigate McCrary.
Yeah.
Let's take that. That would be deficiency. The second prong of Strickland is prejudice. Where is the certification of what McCrary would have testified? Or alternatively, why wasn't McCrary placed on the stand so that the trial court could make credibility determinations as to, number one, what McCrary would have said, and if McCrary would have said it, whether or not it would have been credible? So let's start with that.
That, Your Honor, was established not necessarily by her testimony, but it was stipulated to at the PCR hearing by both parties that there was an investigation performed before the evidentiary hearing. The investigator spoke to McCrary, which
I saw that. That was like a couple-line report by an investigator.
Right, but that was admitted into evidence. So that's
so what?
That's evidence in the hearing.
It's not. How is, so she said she couldn't recall. Why couldn't she recall? Could she not recall because she wasn't with Bowers? Could she not recall because of the distance of time? I mean, there are many, many factors that can come into why a person cannot recall. Are we supposed to guess about that?
Well, I think from the statement that was admitted into evidence by consent of both parties, I think it's hard to second guess why they stipulated that.
But is it? The fact that someone cannot recall doesn't necessarily mean that it impeaches Bowers. I don't recall that. Does she not recall that because I recall the day, but I don't recall ever being with her, or I don't recall anything about the day? Do you understand the distinction that I'm making here?
The point is taken, but I don't think in this instance. Honestly, I don't know. I hate to speculate why they stipulated to this the statements coming into evidence at the hearing rather than calling her. But
when you spoke about the failure to investigate, your point really should be it was the failure not just to investigate, the failure based upon the investigation, to call McGreery, because McGreery would have offered testimony that would have upended Bowers' testimony, or would have, and that I don't see. I just see this failed to investigate McGreery.
Well, the failure to investigate, so a lot of trial counsel's decisions at trial were ascribed by the state and amicus to strategic decisions. And that can't be so, because you can't make a reasonable strategic decision if you haven't performed any investigation.
You're looking for a new trial. That's a big deal, vacating a conviction. And to me, it's problematic that McGreery was not called before the PCR court by someone so that the court could make findings, number one, as to what she might have testified to, and number two, whether she was a credible witness before the PCR court. Wouldn't that have been the appropriate way to proceed?
Well, I can only suggest, again, and I hate to speculate, the defendant shouldn't be penalized because the state agreed that the statement would come in lieu of the testimony. So in other words, in criminal trials, defendant statements come into evidence all the time without them testifying at the trial. I think it's not a far leap. If this is what she said to the investigator, that statement is admitted into evidence at the hearing. That's evidence. So even without her on the stand, a jury could, assuming that she testifies consistent with that statement, which I agree is.
Is that a fair assumption? You've poo-pooed a little bit the strategic choice that this attorney who had 300 trials under his belt had made. And he said she was a loose cannon. She said this to this person. She said the opposite to another person. She was adamant that she was not going to be cooperative. Why wasn't that within the realm of a strategic decision by counsel to avoid a quote-unquote loose cannon?
Again, I touched on this before, he didn't investigate. It was an admitted failure on his part to investigate. He's taking what other people said to him, second and third hand perhaps, about what she might have said. So if he had gone and sent it, if he'd at least sent an investigator to interview this potential witness, then you could ascribe all these decisions that followed to strategy. But you can't do that. The cases are clear. Okay. If you don't investigate, that's not.
But at this stage, that naturally leads us to Justice Albin's question. What do we know would have happened at this point in light of the fact that we don't have a certification from her?
Again, and all I can say on this point is I can just repeat this. This was admitted into evidence by stipulation. So I think it would be perhaps grossly unfair to penalize the defendant in this case after the state agrees that it comes into evidence. So in other words,
that's different. You can admit something to evidence without crediting it. They said, okay, let this be part of the record. Doesn't mean that they were agreeing with your argument.
It's still your burden to demonstrate ineffective assistance, no?
Sure, by a mere preponderance of the evidence. And I would submit, Your Honors, that any of the errors that I've mentioned previously, either standing alone, even though the PCR judge, Judge Walsh, didn't credit the failure to impeach her, the admitted failure of counsel to impeach this critical witness with her prior criminal convictions, that might have been enough. I mean,
Let's focus on that for a second as well, then. Defense counsel pursued a theory of third-party guilt. There was Howard, who said somebody with a red cap was seen at around 8 p.m., and then we have Bowers saying she saw the defendant with a black hoodie at 9 p.m. Was it a reasonable strategy to suggest that another individual committed this offense?
The third-party guilt defense.
Was it a reasonable strategy to pursue that defense?
I think it was. And that really doesn't, it's related to the errors the counsel made here, but.
How's it related, counsel? How is it related to the errors that you allege counsel made, that third-party guilt?
Well, so the appellate division touched on
any of these issues you've raised, how would they in any way support the third-party guilt defense?
Well, there can be a disconnect between whether or not it was overall a reasonable strategy, which I don't suggest that it wasn't, and what counsel actually did in furtherance of that strategy. So, for example, the appellate division mentioned in a footnote how counsel, it was unclear the effect on the outcome of the case. What trial counsel's failure to impeach her, the various versions of the timelines, was. But that was substantial credible evidence in the record, which supported Judge Walsh's ultimate findings of prejudice.
So on the question, how do you respond to your colleague's argument that if you undermine Bowers by impeaching her, you undermine the theory of third-party guilt?
I don't necessarily accept that that's the case. She had given inconsistent statements, and it came into evidence at trial that she had given these inconsistent statements. It was known. Counsel just failed to highlight it. So Bowers had given a statement before trial, you know, saying that she had received a phone call, you know, that someone told her that someone had been shot, and that was contradicted by her actual trial testimony.
And also the failure of counsel to elicit that Bowers said that the crime occurred at approximately 9 o'clock, whereas Howard said it was at 8 o'clock. That would have been consistent with someone else doing it, and Bowers just being completely off about what she was testifying to.
That's right. And that's what I was trying to express when I said it's the strategy overall can be reasonable, and counsel's conduct in furtherance of that strategy, there can be a disconnect between the two where his actions were still unreasonable and deficient.
So another thing concerned me about the potential cross-examination of Bowers. Bowers had pled guilty and was convicted in 2012. The trial was in 2013. Did anyone explore whether or not she was cooperating with the state, the prosecutor's office, in order to get some more lenient treatment on her charges? That would be like typical interest bias cross-examination, and I don't see anything about that.
I haven't either, Your Honor. I think there's nothing I've seen in the record that would suggest that there was investigation into that by trial counsel.
It seems to me that should have been explored by PCR counsel at the PCR level.
So as I was saying, even though Judge Walsh didn't find the impeachments of Bowers via her criminal convictions to be sufficient standing alone, I would submit that the court doesn't necessarily have to accept that. I think.
Can I ask one other question about the PCR investigation that concerns me? Why did PCR counsel not get a certification from the EMT? EMT supposedly is the source of the dying declaration.
I can't answer that.
Typically, that's the way post-conviction relief proceedings are to proceed, by way of certifications, so that we have some relative certainty about what would be testified to in court.
I would agree. I would agree with that. I don't know. I don't have an answer as to why PCR counsel did or did not do certain things. But, like what McCrary's potential testimony would be, I could be mistaken, but I believe that was stipulated to. There was no dispute at the PCR hearing as to whether or not Davis would, or the EMT recorded. There was no dispute as to whether or not that was recorded as a dying declaration. That was admitted into evidence. The judge accepted that would be, that was, when the victim allegedly said, I don't know, that was the dying declaration. I don't think there was any dispute at the evidentiary hearing. So, you know, it might be able to be explained by what the parties agreed to just to save time and for expediency at the PCR hearing. You know, if
I have concern about the PCR court relying on that outside of a certification. The PCR court, in rendering a decision that is vacating a conviction, should be doing so on evidence that is sound and weighty. Do we agree?
Yes, as a general proposition, of course. But I mean, like I said, the parties may stipulate to certain evidence. And it's just not disputed that that's what the dying declaration is. And I think that's what occurred here. That's what the record suggests. So,
But I don't want to beat a dead horse over here. But the question always comes down to, yes, there's something record. Could a witness actually have been produced in court who would have testified to that? And then we would know the surrounding circumstances, which we don't know.
I agree.
Did the jury hear this dying declaration through Anderson's testimony?
I think the appellate division said yes. I think the appellate division said yes, although I'm not familiar with the exact place in the record where that occurred, but I would say yes.
So how do you establish prejudice on this particular point?
Because I think you can't underestimate, and as far as this, the dying declaration, the appellate division was very dismissive of it, as you can see from the opinion and argument as well. You know, they basically said, well, the assailant was wearing a mask, so it seems obvious that the victim wouldn't be able to identify the assailant. I would suggest, though, that these two men knew each other. You know, they had a relationship. I don't remember exactly, going back perhaps years. It would be possible, and it would be possible for the victim to identify him just by build or.
Do we know who actually heard that comment and who wrote that report? You know, what does the record show about the origin of the report and the EMT's role or lack of role in transmitting that information?
We don't, and I think, for some of the same reasons that Justice Alden pointed out, you know, we didn't have that live witness at the evidentiary hearing, but we had what was accepted to be the dying declaration. It appears to be recorded by an EMT. And, you know, as Judge Walsh pointed out, the dying declaration went beyond that because it also was inconsistent with various other testimony at trial that the victim couldn't speak.
But do we know whether this EMT had any role? I mean, there's a lot of focus on this EMT and the failure to investigate and call him. But do we know from this record whether he was the key person in that whole part of the episode here?
We don't.
Isn't it tough to show prejudice from failure to call him and investigate him thoroughly? If we don't even know if he was even a player in what happened.
And I would say, Your Honor, the same thing I said to the appellate division in terms of, as I was starting to say, the appellate division basically took it as an obvious thing that an assailant with wearing a mask couldn't be identified. But before a jury, it's difficult to underestimate the prejudice that could occur by hearing an EMT testify that the victim said, "I don't know who shot me." I mean, it's hard to underestimate that the effect that could have on a jury, and that alone again could be enough that it might have tipped the scales in favor of my client.
Do you know whether or not counsel cross-examined Anderson about his prior criminal record? From your review of the record, do you know?
I do not, offhand, Your Honor.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
I did. I just wanted to spend a few moments, Your Honor, on the cases that I think the court's cases that establish that when a PCR court makes findings of prejudice or lack thereof, as the case may be, following an evidentiary hearing, those findings are entitled to deference and not subject to new weighing of the evidence against Strickland's prejudice prong. The first of those is Nunez-Valdez, which I believe is dispositive of the question presented. There, obviously, an appellate panel decided that the trial court's findings that the defendant had been affirmatively misinformed, the trial court required that his plea be set aside. The appellate division set that aside and said it was not supported by substantial credible evidence. The court made it clear there that the value to be given to a fact must be considered to be a factual finding based on the court's feel of the case. Reversing, the court held that the trial court was not obliged to credit all the defendant's testimony, and the fact finder was entitled to draw inferences from the evidence and make factual findings based on the feel of the case. The key takeaway really from Nunez-Valdez is the court wrote that a reviewing court is required to affirm the findings of the trial court if they could reasonably have been reached on sufficient credible evidence in the record. The second one I've already mentioned is Maselli, and that takes us further into the deference required to fact finding and weighing of the evidence.
I see the findings of the failure to investigate Okay. They seem to be clearly established. The trial counsel should have been talking with these witnesses. But in order to reach the prejudice prong, you've got to know what would have been produced, what the witnesses would have testified to. And if they weren't presented before the PCR court, how do you determine prejudice?
Well, this is really what Your Honor raised before. This is, I don't think it's a far leap when the investigator goes out and takes a statement from McCrary. McCrary says, I don't remember being with Bowers, hearing these threats allegedly made by my client, hearing the argument just hours before the shooting. That's not something that you would fail to recollect. I mean, as a general matter, that's something that you're going to remember forever. I mean,
we don't Bowers said that McCrary was going to lie, and she had reasons for it. Without producing McCrary, there's no probing, no questioning to determine her credibility.
And there wasn't with Bowers either. To be honest, Your Honor, I mean, the point is taken, and I certainly can't say that the witness testified at the PCR hearing when she didn't. But I would submit to the court, we know what this witness would have said. She would have said because she basically said the same thing to Bowers, and she said the same thing to the OPD investigator, that I don't remember this, and these things are critical. And that, had the jury heard that, that would have contradicted Bowers' testimony, and that calls the verdict into question. I think those things easily follow. It's not, I think because it was admitted into evidence, it has to be treated as such. It has to be treated as substantial, credible evidence, what McCrary said to the investigator. And Judge Walsh accepted that, and that was her right to accept it as the fact finder.
Do you agree that the finding of prejudice based upon, I don't recall, ultimately, you call it a mixed question of fact and law, but isn't that a question of law that the appellate division can say, no, this is just not rising to the level of cognizable prejudice?
I think it's always easy to twist the standard of review and to make it reach the result that you want it to reach, right? That's what the appellate division, I would argue, did in this case. They wanted to reach the opposite result. The cases say they can't do that. The standard of review says you can't reach a different result just because that's what you want. Okay, I was going to get to that later, but.
But you're making prejudice a pure factual question. And I'm suggesting in my question that couldn't the appellate division, on these facts that you are emphasizing to us today, have legitimately regarded that as a legal question?
Not exactly.
Why?
I what I was trying to say in my opening was it's not a pure legal question, as Your Honor is suggesting. It's a mixed, it's essentially the same thing that juries do. Juries in criminal cases find the facts, they accept or reject the facts, the judge instructs them on the law, and they have to cross a bridge to get to a verdict, which is ultimately an opinion, right? We know that people are convicted all the time who are not guilty. Maybe not all the time, but it happens. You know what I mean? So a verdict is ultimately an opinion, but there's this feel of the case and weighing of the evidence, which the court is assigned to the fact finder, not the reviewing court, is essentially a mixed bridge that gets to the ultimate legal opinion. So, and I even wrote down, I anticipated the question about facts versus opinion, and there are obviously pure questions of law that are almost indisputable, you know. And
hasn't this court held in an earlier State v. Harris case that application of law of facts to the standard of prejudice is a legal question that can be reviewed and determined at the appellate division or an appellate level?
Certainly, I think that's Manalapan Realty. Also, the applicant.
Isn't it Ambrose Harris?
Could be. Could be more than one case, but yes. But as I said, I think Nunez-Valdez answers Your Honor's question as well, because this is where the court dealt with weight issues and and identification issues and prejudice based on an applicable test. So, you know, we have the same sort of scenario where there's a bridge. There's this sort of bridge between fact and opinion. And, you know, I guess I would say if a verdict was a pure legal question, you know, it's not, it's an opinion. But why wouldn't we have judges rendering verdicts in criminal cases? Because it's based on weighing the evidence, you know, comparing the various witnesses' testimony, assigning importance or relative importance to their testimony, weighing the evidence based on the feel of the case that can only be gained by the fact finder and not a reviewing court on a hearing transcript. So I think Nunez-Valdez really dealt with an analogous situation to this in terms of applying facts to a legal standard with multiple prongs.
And so we understand your argument about the standard of review and the deference that is due. Are there questions anyone would like to present? I think we have your argument then.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Buckley.
Thank you, Your Honors. Could please the court. Factual findings of a PCR court are given deference as long as they are supported by credible evidence in the record. However, a reviewing court is not required to defer to clearly mistaken findings. Indeed, where a trial court's findings are so clearly mistaken, the interests of justice demand intervention and correction. In this case, the appellate division reviewed the findings of the PCR court as well as the trial record below and specifically found that those findings were not supported by the record. In this case, the appellate division looked to the PCR court's conclusions that counsel was ineffective for failing to interview Alicia McCrary, failing to impeach India Bowers, and failing to call Kyle Hasko, the EMT worker, and correctly found that the record did not support those findings. As a result, the appellate division correctly found that the trial counsel's representation of defendant was not ineffective. Moreover, when the appellate division looked to the second prong of Strickland, it properly weighed the purported errors committed by trial counsel against the proofs presented by the state at trial and correctly found that the defendant failed to establish prejudice. The appellate division decision reversing the PCR court's order granting of post-conviction relief was firmly grounded in the record and in the law and should be affirmed by this court.
Are you done with your opening statement?
Yes.
Bowers gave some damaging testimony, whether she's the most important witness or not. She says the defendant threatened the victim at around 6 o'clock. The defendant shot the victim at 9 o'clock, and she saw the defendant leaving. Why wouldn't that naturally lead a defense attorney to impeach a witness with that sort of damaging testimony?
Well, I think if you look at the statement of India Bowers, the pretrial statement that she had given, there was a lot of evidence in there that also directly implicated the defendant, which was not as clear in her testimony at trial. So just taking India Bowers' testimony with regard to the argument. She indicated that was consistent in both her pretrial statement as well as her trial testimony that on her way to the store, she overheard this dispute between Antonio Davis and the defendant. So that was something that was consistent. With regard to her comment, her statement as to when she saw the defendant running from the scene, that was inconsistent. But I would submit that looking at her statement pre-trial, it is far more powerful than the statement that she actually makes at trial.
Isn't that one reason why it would be expected that defense counsel would have impeached her on that previous statement versus the statement she testified to during trial?
Well, I disagree. I think that if he had brought out that she was more powerful in her a statement to the police prior to trial than she was at trial, that would bring out the fact that in her pretrial statement, she said she placed herself at the scene. She indicated that she saw this defendant running from the incident and that he ran past her.
The inconsistencies from her statements, they're pretty significant inconsistencies. She says pretrial that she was outside coming back from the store, and she saw the defendant run past her, apparently right after the shooting occurred. Then she testifies at trial that she was home, in her home, received a call that someone had been shot, and she goes downstairs to see what happened, and then defendant runs past her. A significant difference in how she viewed the defendant, the timing, because it, in her original statement, she's saying he ran right past her apparently after it had just occurred. In the statement at trial, apparently she had time to take a phone call, walk downstairs, and then defendant was running from the scene. So those are pretty significant differences in her testimony that I think it would be natural for any defense attorney to impeach her on, because that's a credibility issue as to whether she's lying to the jury or whether she was lying previously.
Well, I think what trial counsel testified to during the PCR hearing was that her testimony at trial fed nicely into his theory of third-party guilt. He testified that her trial testimony established that the defendant was running. He had different clothing on than was described by Marilyn Howard. He was wearing a head rag, and he was running from the scene. He did not have a gun. He did not have a mask, and that this was helpful to him in the sense that he wanted the jury to believe that India Bowers saw the defendant running from the scene as people would run from a shooting, and Marilyn Howard saw the shooter, who was dressed differently, with a red hat, with a logo, with a ski mask, and with a gun.
But wouldn't it have also been helpful to completely discount Bowers and focus on Marilyn Howard's testimony that fit with the timeline of the shooting? And again, as you just noted, you know, apparently she saw someone dressed completely differently than defendant.
Well, I think that what was clear in trial counsel's testimony in the PCR hearing was that this was a strategic decision. He made the decision not to impeach her with regard to those to that statement because he indicated he did not want to discredit too much that statement that she made, that she had seen the defendant. She was able to identify him. He did not have a gun. He did not have a ski mask, and be able to make those two separate identifications and try to.
I understand these.
What about cross-examining her about the two prior convictions she had, which even defense counsel said was a mistake not to have done?
Yes, he did say that it was a mistake to not cross-examine her with regard to the two prior convictions. And Justice Alvin, just to indicate, you had said, why wasn't she cross-examined as with regard to any, whether she was cooperating? Those were two convictions that she received, 1 year probation concurrent to a 2 year probation. By the time this case had gone to trial, she had already served the majority of her probationary sentence.
I know, but look at the timeline. The trial is 2013.
Correct.
The state is preparing its case at the very time that the prosecuting agency that's prosecuting this defendant is making these arrangements for her. That would have been the most natural line of questioning, in addition to the convicting. Didn't you plead guilty to this, that? And were you cooperating with the state in order to cut a good deal on those two charges? That's the most natural line of examination by a defense attorney. Do you agree?
I agree, except that her initial statement was given years prior to this.
I understand, but
and that her initial statement was consistent with regard to the argument that she had heard between Antonio Davis and defendant.
But not so consistent for the reasons that Justice Pierre-Louis brought out. The timing was off, and that timing would be consistent with third-party guilt. Bowers is saying it occurred 9 o'clock. And Howard is saying at 8 o'clock, which tends to totally undercut Bowers' testimony. And if you throw McGreery into the pile there, McGreery, at least in that statement, said, "I was walking with Bowers when Bowers claims to have heard that threat." So this is the question. I mean, how could it be reasonable for a defense attorney not to question McGreery, not to investigate what she would have said? How could that possibly be a strategic decision to act through ignorance?
Well, I don't think that, I think the trial counsel explained it very clearly why he didn't do that. Alicia McCrary had indicated on two occasions, first she never mentioned anything in her statement and then went to an India Bowers to and was angry with her that she'd even given her name.
That's what Bowers says. McCrary doesn't say that. That's coming from Bowers' mouth. Well, I want to know, how could it be a rational strategy not to speak with a potential witness who will undermine the state's star witness?
Well, I guess I take issue with the fact that she would have undermined the state's star witness. I take issue with the fact that this India Bowers was not the most important witness. That's the first thing. The second thing would be that there's nothing in the record to show that she would have undermined India Bowers' statement. In fact, even the report that was issued by the investigator during the PCR hearing, it only stated that she doesn't recall, doesn't know, quote, I don't know anything about that, which would indicate that she was did not want to be involved in this
for
case.
For the reasons that I was suggesting my question, we don't know unless she would have been put on the stand. She could have said, I don't recall that because I was never with Bowers. That's the reason why I don't recall it. And so that would be a direct impeachment of Bowers if that were her testimony. We don't know what it would be.
Correct. And in that regard, I think that the defendant failed to meet his burden to establish what she would have said and why in any way that he was prejudiced. That was his burden at the PCR hearing to establish that, in fact, her testimony was going to contradict India Bowers. And there's absolutely nothing in this record, whether it's pretrial statements or whether it's the PCR hearing or statements at trial, that would indicate that Alicia McCrary had any evidence that was going to contradict India Bowers. That is simply speculation as to what she would or she may have testified to. And in that regard, even if you accept that it was ineffective to not interview McCrary, there's nothing to indicate the defendant was prejudiced by counsel failing to investigate that. And I would also submit that trial counsel during his PCR hearing had a very specific reason. She was a loose cannon. She and India Bowers were not reliable.
I saw that these rationalizations. How do you know unless you actually speak with the witness? After the fact rationalization, when you're on the stand and someone's claiming you're ineffective assistance, I understand that. But explain to me how it could be rational not to speak with the witness to see whether or not she would be solid or a loose cannon.
Because the information up to that point was indicative of the fact that she was a loose cannon. He knew who she was. She was the girlfriend of a person who was already there and also refused to be involved. And to counsel's point, to trial counsel's point, even if he had put her on, he had no idea what she was going to say, and that there were things that she could say that would hurt her, that would hurt him. Even in her statement that she gave to police, she was aware of the dispute between Antonio Davis, Wes Johnson, and the defendant. She knew all of the feuding that had gone on before. She was involved with the people who were selling drugs at that location.
I understand your prejudice argument. I don't understand the argument that, oh yeah, it's a rational trial strategy not to speak with a potential witness. That I don't understand.
Well,
and that goes also, and you can respond to that, for the EMT. Why defense counsel wouldn't have attempted to speak with the EMT?
Well, I think in his PCR testimony, he does indicate that he was the one who, in fact, investigated this. He subpoenaed Kyle Hasko to trial. There was a subpoena that was issued. There was an investigation that was done, and that he indicated that he may have spoken to this witness, but he couldn't recall. So I think to indicate that he didn't investigate this is really contrary to the record. He, in fact, did do his due diligence in trying to find out who issued this report, in issuing the subpoena. And I would suggest that the evidence as to this the statement made by this EMT is flimsy at best. As Justice Patterson pointed out, There's no evidence that this EMT ever even uttered that statement. The report, in fact, the EMT report does have a statement made by the defendant. It says, I got shot in the face. There's nothing to indicate that there was a dying declaration. The statement comes from a medical examiner report wherein Stephanie Barrows, the emergency room nurse, says an EMT says his dying words were, I don't know who shot me. So this was just a hearsay upon hearsay upon hearsay that trial counsel attempted to track down to find out who actually even said this and indicated that he subpoenaed Kyle Hasko. So he did, in fact, investigate, but couldn't recall why he didn't call him, and that it was likely that he did not have competent evidence.
Look, an investigation would be an investigator goes down and speaks with the people to find out who made the statement. That's a reasonable investigation. Not throwing willy-nilly at a subpoena.
I would say that trial counsel made a sufficient effort in tracking down who this was. He couldn't recall whether or not he had spoken to him, but that he had determined that it was not competent evidence, primarily because he had looked in his file. There was evidence that he remembered researching the issue. He remembered speaking to the defendant about it, and the defendant was very involved in this part. The other part of that is that looking to the prejudice prong of this, PCR counsel didn't introduce any evidence as to who even uttered this statement, or that it was even uttered. And additionally, as it was pointed out, Marquand Anderson actually said when the defendant was shot, he asked him, "Did you see who shot you?" And he said, "No." And as the appellate division also correctly noted, this victim was sitting on a milk crate in a vestibule. The defendant came in wearing a mask and shot him in the side of the face, and that it would not have been unreasonable for him to not have seen who shot him. And that was not a situation where looking straight on with someone that you recognize to say, I don't know who shot me, because you didn't recognize that person. That was not this type of a situation. So there was, even if it were to be found that defendant, that trial counsel was ineffective for not pursuing this, there's no prejudice to the defendant because this evidence was already in the record. It would have been cumulative at best.
Ms. Buckley, I want to go back to Bauer's testimony at trial. Was counsel deficient for not cross-examining her about her priors? And if not, why not?
I would have to say that it would not have been reasonable for counsel to not cross-examine India Bowers with regard to her two prior convictions. I know
Tell
that was
why.
Kind of a little circular. I think that there were certain things that he wanted to diminish her credibility about, in particular, the argument that was heard beforehand, and it would have been it would have at least brought out the two convictions that she had. That being said, even the PCR court indicated that that alone would not have been ineffective, would not have prejudiced defendant, because there were many witnesses at trial who had prior records, and the jury credited their testimony. So it would not have prejudiced the defendant. The defendant was not prejudiced by counsel's failure to impeach India Bowers with regard to these two prior convictions.
Is there anything else you'd like to present?
I believe that's all that I have, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Buckley.
Thank you.
Mr. Finkelstein.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner, and may it please the court. Defendant failed to support his ineffective assistance claim with sufficient credible evidence in the record, and the PCR court made several critical errors when granting defendant's petition because defendant never proved deficiency and prejudice. The appellate division did exactly what it was supposed to do. It reversed based on a legal determination, and that is the standard of review on appeal. It is a question of law. Deficiency and prejudice are both legal questions, and the appellate division should not be criticized for doing exactly what it was supposed to do. I want to try to address as many of the questions that I've heard so far as best as I can. And so I'll start with the Chief Justice's questions about Bauer's prior convictions. So an attorney cannot be considered deficient for not attacking, a defense attorney can't be considered deficient for not attacking what is, in essence, the defense's best witness. So the defense's best witness in this case is Bauer's, because Bauer's creates a contrast with Howard and supports this third-party guilt defense that was defendant's main defense and the best chance for acquittal here. So an attorney cannot be considered deficient for not attacking the defense's best chance for an acquittal. And so there's no deficiency there, and certainly no prejudice as well. And I do also want to focus on what has been a focus in this case, this question of one of the most important witnesses. So the appellate division under the second prong considers this de novo, because it's a legal question, considers whether there's prejudice de novo, because it is a legal question. And the appellate division was simply making a point. This statement, I believe, is being taken out of context. The appellate division was simply pointing out that the issues between the defendant and the victim were explored through other witnesses as well, in addition to Bauer's. And so just to clarify as well, the mixed question term, I think, can be a little bit misleading, because there really aren't mixed questions in a certain sense. There are factual questions, which the PCR court makes the determination of, based on sufficient credible evidence in the record. And then there's a legal question. There's separate questions. Based on the proper factual findings, then you make a legal determination. So they're not mixed in any kind of sense that would matter. They're completely separate when you're doing the legal determination after you've determined which facts you're looking at. So I don't think the mixed question idea is helpful in any way in this case, and it can actually be quite misleading. And so a few other questions that I wanted to address as well. There's a question about the potential deal, hypothetically, between Bauer's and the state as far as the sentence that Bauer's received for her prior convictions. So that is, at this point, complete speculation. It's not an issue in this case as far as the PCR court never addressed it. It was not raised at the PCR court, so it is complete speculation as to whether the sentence Bauer's received, whether there was any kind of deal for Bauer's with the state. In addition, I wanted to mention address the question about deficiency as far as failing to interview McCrary. So I think that was addressed with counsel, but I wanted to add one detail about it in terms of McCrary's interview with the police. So certainly we agree that the defense counsel never interviewed McCrary, but there is Bauer's statement where Bauer says, this is what McCrary said to me, that she's not going to be involved in this case. She doesn't want to be involved. She doesn't want to be a snitch. And then also, I think this hasn't been mentioned, so I just want to mention that in McCrary's interview with the police, it does appear that she is either lying to the police or misleading the police or not giving complete information, because she says that she doesn't know what Davis, the victim, was doing in this vestibule at the time. They ask her about this, try to get this information from her. Whether they already had it or not, I don't know. But she says she doesn't know what he was doing there. And then they clarify, say, how long have you lived in the apartment complex? And she says 7 years. So it's from that interview, it does seem like the police believes that she perhaps knows that there was drug dealing taking place in the vestibule of the Karma apartment complex. So that would support the idea that counsel isn't going to obtain any supporting evidence from McCrary. And for all those reasons, the appellate division, if there are no further questions, the appellate division correctly reversed, and this court should respectfully affirm the appellate division judgment.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement.